I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega. You're listening to The Takeaway. We've been talking about the aftermath of George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis. Floyd's death didn't just spur calls for police reform there, but in cities and states across the U.S. So where do things stand now? Here to walk us through the state of police reform in the U.S. is Jamiles Larte, staff writer at the Marshall Project. Jamiles, glad to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I want to start with the latest from Congress. Last week, the House passed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. Is this noteworthy in and of itself, even though, you know, it hasn't passed in the Senate yet? What is the significance of just the vote itself, and what does the bill do?
Sure. I think that's a yes and no question, right? I mean, on one level, it is a pretty dramatic piece of legislation in terms of addressing policing. On the other hand, it was passed last year in the House and wasn't taken up by the Senate, and it seems fairly unlikely to gain traction in the Senate this session. I mean, the Democrats would need to keep the entire party together on this question, which isn't a guarantee, and then would need to get 10 Republicans to join them in promoting this bill. And it seems like the qualified immunity portion of the bill is going to really just make that impossible.
The effort to eliminate qualified immunity
or yeah,
to
correct.
Scale it back. Yeah. In the weeks and months following the killing of George Floyd, states all over the country rushed to pass their own police reform bills. Do we have a sense of how many of those actually became law?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I would caution against sort of trying to come up with hard numbers, because all of these states are starting from different places in terms of what's the law in the books. And then the laws that were proposed and, you know, either passed or failed all had different components to them, right? So it's difficult or maybe unwise to kind of group them all together and say, you know, these are all the places that passed bills. I'd say Colorado probably went the furthest of all the states that were able to pass bills, because they did address this question of qualified immunity. And, you know, for listeners who may be unfamiliar with the term, that's a legal doctrine that says effectively that government workers can't be held liable for what they do on the job, except in rare circumstances. It's a doctrine that was judicially created in the 1960s and has been slowly but surely expanded by courts in the meanwhile. I think another thing that we see in the laws that have passed in the wake of George Floyd's death is they kind of come of a few different varieties, and many states kind of bundled all of these things together. But there are laws that are inspired by the death of Breonna Taylor that address no-knock raids. There are laws that were inspired by the death of George Floyd that often touched on banning chokeholds or carotid restraint. And more generally, many of these laws have endeavored to address kind of broader systemic policing things like qualified immunity, which sort of speaks to whether the difficulty in holding police officers accountable and I guess in some respects personally liable for their actions on the job.
And what about defunding the police? Has that call translated into policy or budget moves of any significance anywhere around the country?
I think probably what's more reasonable to say is that the pandemic has had the effect of defunding local government, which has included the police, right? So many municipalities have seen their tax base really wither and crumble in the loss of sales tax and, you know, all different ways that governments fund themselves. So, you know, to give you an example, I live in New Orleans, and here our police budget is being cut to the point where officers are under a mandatory over a month of furlough. They've got to take, I think, 26 unpaid days off next year just to try to cover some of the budget shortfall. So we're seeing that in cities around the country much more than we're seeing the actual sort of implementation of defund. What we certainly are seeing in a lot of places is experimentation pilot programs to use this term, unbundle the police, right? To take some of the activities that police currently do, or some of the situations that police currently respond to, and to offload those to civilian agencies, folks who don't carry guns. We have seen a fair degree of that. That is not always necessarily tied to changes in funding, which have to happen as a matter of legislation and have to sort of go through a process.
What are some of the challenges that those who want more radical changes to police departments are facing? Is it police unions that are the major obstacle?
Police unions are certainly an obstacle, or maybe to be more specific, police union contracts are an obstacle, because there's many changes that have been proposed and that, quite honestly, a lot of police chiefs would be open to. But the union contract, which only comes up every so many years, prevents those types of those types of reforms from being implemented. So that's certainly a large piece standing in the way. I think more broadly, what's standing in the way of reforms, or of reimagining, or any, you know, whichever term you want to use, is just the inertia of the system, right? The system has grown and developed over many, many years to be this way, and it's very hard to turn that kind of thing around.
Jamiles Larte is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. Jamiles, thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So now we turn to you. Last year, we heard from many of you of your participation in the George Floyd protests. Now, nearly 1 year later, as we see the trial for Officer Derek Chauvin coming up, we hear from you again on whether you have continued to be involved and what you hope for in terms of police reform.
Hey, this is Joel from Bremerton, Washington. I would like to see any officer who is forced to use deadly force removed from his job and never be able to be any type of cop ever again. We just can't have police out there with kill records. I would also like to be able to see a cop's disciplinary record every time there is an incident.
I'm not aware of any tangible police reforms in Texas, or at least in Dallas where I live. I'd like to see no-knock warrant banned, chokeholds banned, use of deadly force against unarmed suspects prosecuted, not only banned, but prosecuted the same way that persons not on the police force would be prosecuted. That's, in my opinion, that's murder. That's not self-defense like police would like to claim.
I'm not aware of any police reform in my own small rural town, but in the broader community and nearby municipalities, I would love to see a plan or policy that doesn't automatically send armed officers with weapons drawn to any unusual situation. In many cases, dispatching social workers would be much more effective.
This is Lou in Falmouth, Massachusetts on Cape Cod. I've been involved with protests against police brutality, especially after George Floyd's and many other murders. I'm still engaged, and what I want to see is a major reallocation of funding away from policing to other services and resources that have a much greater long-term impact on crime, on civil unrest, the peace, and social, emotional, and physical safety and well-being.
This is Simon Spenton in Gilbert, Arizona. After the savage killing of George Floyd and others, the reforms I'd like to see are threefold. One, chokehold deaths are homicide, period. Two, no policing of blacks by whites. There are too many bad apples in uniform. And three, until two is in place, either party should have the right to summon an independent third party to referee the interaction between them.
I am Vanessa Walker of St. Simons Island, Georgia. My 18-year-old daughter and I protested the injustice system in our community in Glenn County, Georgia last year. This is where Ahmaud Arbery was shot down by the son of a retired officer of the local district attorney's office. Our demonstrations were peaceful but direct and focused. We had twin goals of seeking justice for Aubrey's death and accountability of the DA. A diverse group of citizens worked to register new voters, demand justice, and change in the system. We successfully elected a write-in candidate to defeat the incumbent DA. I'm relocating to Atlanta with a dream of working with Stacey Abrams to improve voter rights and preserve enfranchisement. With the onslaught of proposed legislation to curtail voting rights, now is a critical time to pay attention and act to keep including all legal voters. To me, this is the clearest path to an improved, responsive, and inclusive country for every one of us.
My name is Pam Graber. I'm calling from Sebastopol, California. Yes, I have attended some protests regarding that brutality. And yes, I am on a white allyship journey. It was inspired by the 28-day exercise found in the book Me and White Supremacy.
Thank you for calling us. Remember, you can always call in to 877-8-MY-TAKE and share your thoughts or record a voice memo and email it to us at takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.